Hi, my name's Adam Ferrier, and this is Uncommon.
Uncommon is a production focused on the why of business, media, and marketing. It's made by my team at Neural, a digital agency for challenger brands and talent. To learn more, just visit neural.com. That's N-E-U-R-A-L-L-E.com. My guest this week, Adam Ferrier, founder, Thinkabell, and consumer psychologist, co-host of The Black T-Shirts on Listener. First thing I had when I went through all your research and went through all your notes was, how do you exactly exit a cult?
It's a good question. So I used to be a cult exiter. I used to do it on the side. I got interested in when a friend of mine got taken by the Church of Scientology. And I was actually just a cult pest for a while. So I used to go to Landmark Education and Church of Scientology, just kind of disrupt the proceedings a bit and just implore people who were there to look into, you know, look up on Google Landmark Education and cult or Church of Scientology and cult. And then I got cease and desist letters from them and you know, just that kind of thing. But yeah, I just hate them. But what's really fascinating is that cults use the same principles as psychologists. They just dial them up to 1,000. And I could talk about cults all day. So if you want me to, I will.
My wife and I, who's the co-founder in this business, we are just utterly fascinated by it. Have you watched Going Clear?
I think so. Yes, I have.
Okay, so this Going Clear, if I just look it up, is the most recent doco and, 2015, and it is utterly fascinating, like you said, and the way the systems that they use, the psychology that they use to basically convince people that they have problems with their lives and therefore this cult can fix those problems.
That's right. I mean, I'll just talk to you about a couple of the fascinating principles, right? And there's a good book called The Culting of Brands that's taking the principles of cults and applies them into brand building, if anybody wants to go down that route.
Yeah, right.
One of the really interesting things I do is I used to have these, we're talking about Landmark Education at the moment as one of my favorite cults. And they used to have these nights on a Tuesday night where they'd come and you'd have to invite somebody in. If you're about to graduate, have graduation nights, you'd invite a friend to come and watch you graduate or a few friends. And that obviously spreads the word of the cult. But once you're there, they then ask people to stand up and share something personal about them with the promise that it will set you free from the burden of this thing that you want to share with the cult. But what it does is if you stand up and declare something about yourself that's kind of personal, then you have to post-rationalize the fact that you've just done this to this group of strangers, thinking, oh, they're really good people, it's a really safe environment. So just by disclosing something personal of yourself to the cult binds you to the cult a little bit more, and then a bit more, a bit more, a bit more. And so, and then the other thing they do is they start to break up your relationships with people who aren't in the cult. So then you have to get exercises where you have to go and confront people who have done you wrong in the past for some reason, and then it just creates friction. So you either draw people in or you create friction with people who aren't in the cult, and then you create really strong in-groups and out-groups. There's a whole lot of other kind of techniques that they use, and marketers are going, oh, wow, I can use this, and psychologists are going, yeah, that's just what I do every day. And you know, but it's just fascinating, the good exponents of these principles, how much damage they can do.
Do you think, I don't think it's very realistic to say that some brands do that. There are some brands that have that sway over people, but not to that degree. Like, you know, it's ratcheting it up.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the Church of Scientology is a brand, right?
Yeah.
Landmark Education is a brand. The Catholic Church, to a lesser extent, is a brand, but I wouldn't say they're necessarily a cult.
Yeah.
But, you know, so it's just, Collingwood Football Club, it just depends on how culty you want to be, I guess.
There's a spectrum.
Yeah, that's right. Put it on a spectrum, not dichotomously different. And then there's stickiness in everything, right?
Yeah. How did you, like, I was reading about you and reading a lot of things that you write about yourself as well, and looking at your background, how you got into this area. So, you know, undergrad, arts, psychology, commerce, marketing, postgrad, diploma of psych, and then you did your master's of psychology and clinical psychology. But before that, did you ever have this like inkling of this people fascinate me, therefore I will do psychology? Or is it one of those things where you sit down with like a school counselor and they're like, oh, you're good at these subjects, you should do this. And then it sort of fit your personality. Like, what about you, Adam, and your personality suits this stuff?
I used to trade shares on the landline at lunchtime at school. So there was one landline, and every lunchtime I'd trade shares all lunch hour, and then I'd go back to class. And I was always known as the kind of the slightly odd kind of share market kind of guy. But I was also really fascinated and really interested in people, how they tick, you know, constantly asking why, all that kind of shit. But I was failing school badly. I went to see a tutor, and the tutor said, what are your interests? And I said, money and people. And the tutor, a guy called Kim Sawyer, said, you should become a consumer psychologist. And I thought, oh, wow, I don't even know what one is, but that sounds perfect. So I studied commerce. And I studied psychology. I did my thesis in identifying the underlying constructs of cool people, because I knew it was a way to commercialize my psychological understanding. And so that's always been the interplay, right? And so that person changed my life by being so deft at being able to tease out my interests so precisely. The whole forensic thing and the cult stuff was just happenstance, and that when I graduated, I needed a job, and the easiest place to get a job was in corrective services, because my girlfriend's mum was the head of psychological services for New South Wales Corrections.
Wow.
So I got a job there, and then that was equally fascinating as well, right? So I reckon a really interesting thing is, even if you have a goal, that doesn't mean there's not other things in life that are going to be really interesting. So just stay open to those as well. And so I've been able to, in my early career, I've been able to blur all that stuff together. Which is kind of cool, kind of lucky, I guess.
Yeah, those deviations are quite interesting. And they build a part of your personality, which become interesting, vulnerable stories, I would say.
Yeah, definitely. And when everything is so flittery these days, and you know, and everyone's got superficial interest in everything, being able to go deep in a parallel interest to what you currently do is really important, and kind of just rewiring the brain in a way that's really different but quite deep, because you'll constantly draw on that and see things in a slightly different way as well.
Yeah, because my deviation was because I'd worked in hospitality. I'm kind of similar to you in that I'd always been fascinated by people and money. I just wasn't aware of it up until I was maybe even 25. I just didn't have that self-awareness. But at least before that, when I was at uni, I'd fallen into the world of hospitality as any good wog does. And I don't know why, but like wine became a thing. It became a part of like, you know, a badge of honor, part of my personality. And so I worked there as like a sommelier, like a wine taster, wine buyer for a while at a bunch of different restaurants. So it's always intriguing how, like, I end up hating it. Like, I truly believed that I was going to become a restaurateur with this commercial knowledge and this intrigue in hospitality. But eventually I found myself into the corporate world. Did you ever have that moment where you're working in the corrections facilities and you're like, oh, I'm going to become this very important criminologist that starts writing about these people? Or had you always had this one set? You know,
I know your question. I'm going to cut you short, but I love the question because I've got the perfect answer. A friend of mine worked for Rio Tinto, and he invited all, and he was maybe 27, and I was working corrective services in Bathurst Prison, and he decided to have a lunch at Rockpool in the Rocks in Sydney. And all of his mates were there, and all of our mates were there, but they all had these corporate kind of gigs, and I was there from back the bloody prison. And I thought, oh, shit, there's just got to be more. There's more fun out there than being stuck in the prison. And it kind of reignited my quest or my like for money and the things that it avails to you.
Yeah.
So that was my moment. But just also on your sommelier thing, Seth Godin has written a good book called "All Marketers Are Liars," and he uses Riddle glasses. And I think being so interesting because there's so much subtlety and nuance. Oh, can you taste the black currant? Oh, yeah, I can taste the black currant. And just that subtlety is so much about what good marketing is about, and being able to pick up on that and play into those, I don't know, people's perceptions of things. So I'm sure that experience will bode you well for the rest of your life.
Yeah, I mean, Riddell is the greatest. It's an interesting observation because I just read Byron Sharp's book, and it talks about how you need to build market brand assets. And Riddell is the perfect example of that, in that, like, at the end of the day, they're just glass blowers. Like, they make glassware. And at the end of the day, there is no scientific reason for wine to taste better in this glass versus that glass. There is legitimately no reason other than the suggestiveness of the Riddell brand.
That's right. There's a backstory, but there's not a reason.
There's no reason. It's the way that they do it as well, like the family. It is so, like, magical. It is what, you know, often what you guys as an agency can sometimes bring to a brand. What was the tagline here? I had it written down somewhere. Measured magic.
Yeah, tagline is measured magic, with his marketing sciences meets hardcore creativity. But I think there's a really, just in terms of what you're talking about, there's a really nice saying about advertising. I forget who said it, but it's advertising is the wonder in Wonder Bread.
Yeah.
So it's nice. It's the marketable.
So like, if you look at, like, they build, it's sort of like, I don't know if have you watched Severance recently? No. Show?
Yeah, yeah.
For people listening, I strongly recommend they go say it. It is like a cult. They build up this idea of the Egan family and Keir, who's the founder, and they do the same thing. Johan is the founder in the Riddell family. They've got a story, and the way that they dress is so cliche and so cool that it sort of just permeates the brand even further. My experience of Riddell was, everyone was like, oh, Riddell, you have to have Riddell at a restaurant. There was Spieglau, which is a very good competitor and as nice to look at glassware. But the way that the Riddell family would come in and they'd tour Australia, or the son would do it, or the sister would do it, and they would just come in and they would do this whole, it was like seeing a magician. That's what it is. It's that suggestiveness of, like, now smell this in this paper cup. Smell this wine. Now pour it into your Riddell glass. And doesn't that smell so much better? You can really get notes of, what did you say before? Blueberry.
Yeah.
So it's amazing. I love it.
And a good sommelier, or a good, anyone can do that on a one-to-one level, a really strong. And when people try to think about a big brand, it's trying to take that and trying to operationalize that and ritualize that. And all of those characters, those signs, those symbols, those rituals, just trying to get all of that systematized so you can build scale with that, is really, really hard. And that's where I think the next big wave in marketing or my industry is kind of going, is taking that and operationalizing those things at scale.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the hard part, is operationalizing it. That's a good point. We're going to jump on, like, more marketing science later, because, like I said, I've gone deep on Byron Scharf, Mark Ritson, and all those sort of guys.
Yeah,
and it's opened my mind. Just a quick one. What did you think you were going to be growing up? Like, what was the job you thought you'd have?
It's good. Yeah, I was good with my hands, and I've always been good with people. So Mum suggested I become a hairdresser.
Okay.
And so at one stage I thought about being a hairdresser. Then I was going to be a school teacher. I honestly never thought I could be happy being gainfully employed. I never thought I'd be able to have a job working all the time where I'd be happy doing that. So I can remember getting a job at Credit Services, just being happy that I was happy, just thinking, oh, fuck, I can do something and it's kind of cool. So I always had quite low ambitions of any kind of corporate life. And the fact that I've been able to achieve something is quite amazing. In my own head.
Yeah, right. Well, how old were you when you thought that?
Oh, it's all through forever until it happened. I think I was always worried about not being able to be satisfied. You know, always trying to think of myself as an outsider and having to be maverick or living the life of an artist or something, but not being happy being. Yeah, and even the money thing, right? Because that was also created a bit of dissonance for me because I wanted to be wealthy, but wondering how the fuck that was going to happen.
As an artist. Yeah. it doesn't really work, does it?
Anyway, yeah.
What did your parents do?
My dad was a judge and my mum's an artist. And so, yeah, and then my uncle was very wealthy. And so there was a famous book in the 80s called Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And it was about a very dutiful father, but he also had, I think it was actually his mate's dad who was really rich. And so he used to learn a lot of lessons. So my uncle used to teach me about the share market and all that kind of stuff. My mum instilled in me kind of this whole idea about being different and being an artist and following your passions. And my dad was kind of pretty steady and dutiful.
Yeah, right. Interesting. Is there, and you think those are the two lessons that you pulled for them, is that your father was a structured, reason-based man, and your mother was creative in the highest sense?
I reckon you could correlate it like that. I don't know if there's a cause and effect, but I was very much, mum especially championed me to be maverick and be your own person and all that kind of stuff. And but she also really instilled in me a hate of order and structure. And yeah, so right. I never really got the order and structure bit happening in a kind of coherent way.
Yeah, right. Interesting.
Sorry, buddy. To the point now that I still look down on people, and I know I shouldn't, who are really structured. Like, it takes all my effort to think, that's really valuable, those skills of being ordered and structured. It takes effort because it's not innate for me, because I've learned not to admire those skills.
Yeah,
and right. I often try to create little whirlwinds of chaos wherever I go, much to the fucking annoyance of everyone around me.
Okay, so post-uni, maximum security prisons, you get the job at Saatchi & Saatchi. Help me piece together the insights that you pulled before you started Naked in 2004.
So working in corrective services was very important in terms of looking at inmates and prisoners, and nobody, even no matter how horrific or barbaric your crimes are, nobody wants to see themselves as a bad person. So we often post-rationalise all of our behaviours to see ourselves in the best possible light. And seeing that happen at an extreme level, how easy it is to distort your own cognitions, was really interesting for me to understand the power you've got over your own head in terms of how you want to see yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Coupled that, there's a brief period there where I worked for a brand consultancy, during which time I finished my thesis in The Cool Thing. And so I was a cool hunter for a little while. And they just taught me about trends and all that kind of stuff. And I think with trends and understanding brands and the layers of influence and stuff like that, with a kind of a relatively deep knowledge of how people actually operate and work, I was able to go into strategy in a creative agency with my feet pretty firmly on the ground and thinking, oh, this is interesting because I get this, I understand this world.
Mm.
And then I did that for about a year and then started Naked with two friends about a year after that. And again, the whole thing about being a psychologist as well, a bit coming back to the whole riddle thing, psychology has done a pretty good job of branding itself in terms of thinking, if you say you're a psychologist, people think, oh, fuck, this person understands people better than anyone. And the whole thing about, oh, don't shrink me and all that kind of stuff still exists. And so it's kind of like a real good foundation for my career, really.
Okay, so that's quite a quick jump. 1 year and then you've got your own firm. Was that part of your, do you think that's because of your personality type? And more specific to that, how does someone who's been in the industry for a year go out there and be different? You know, like normally you would exist have tenure in the business and you would have clients that trust you and respect you because it is a relationship business. What was that first 2 years like?
It's an excellent observation and you're 100% right. The thing we had going for us was Naked. Naked was like a franchise model. It had started 4 years before in the UK and then the guys in the UK knew one of my mates in Sydney and said, we're thinking of starting an office in the APAC region. Do you guys want to start that? And we said, yes. And so we became partners in the business and then we started locally. So we were able to leverage a bit of their, they didn't really have any.
Okay.
Yeah, they didn't have, so there's no relationships, but in the UK, because our market looks up to the UK businesses are cool there. We were able to leverage their coolness. We got a lot of flack. I like your question because it lets me talk about this. We got a lot of flack for not really having earned our stripes. And so everyone kind of looked down on us. My partner was much younger than I. The third partner was a little bit older, but he had a bit of a thing, but there was still that kind of thing of, oh, you're too young or you're too naive or haven't been in the market long enough to take you seriously. So there was a fair bit of resentment. And then I think we used that resentment really well, where we became quite antagonistic to the market and spoke about hating the way the market was traditionally done and really kind of dived into that and really amplified it and played with it.
Antagonistic to your clients in that you would say, look, we hate how things are done. You're bored with it. Let's do things different. Was that the kind of mindset you took?
Perfect. Yeah. So say, we only want ambitious marketers. We don't want anybody. If you're the type of client who's really happy with how things are, then we're not the agency for you. And there's a whole lot of other agencies who'll keep on doing that. So just playing off that anxiety a little bit about people wanting to make a name for themselves, and then playing off the rest of the industry because the industry is pretty consolidated into big holding groups, and so you're able to piss off a lot of people in big holding groups really easily by just talking down at the holding group level and without singling anyone else out in particular. So everyone's kind of mildly annoyed with you, but nobody really individually hates you.
Yeah, so, yeah. No, that's a good way to take it. And I guess I'm curious, what was the client, when was or who was the client that you landed when you realized this strategy of, look, if you want to make a name for yourself, you're going to work with us. If you want to be middle of the road, you go with WPP or Publicis or whatever. When was that?
Yeah, there's 2 points to that. Within about 3 months, even straight away, we landed Absolute, and Absolute, instead of doing any kind of advertising, put all of our money into creating a thing called the Absolute Cut Bar, which was this kind of art installation where we took a photo of the city every minute and made an art installation of that. And that was all cuts of a city. And the brand they launched was Absolute Cut, which was an RTD, which went relatively well. But it was a really good proof point of how you can spend your money differently and do different things. But then a few months after that, we won the Coca-Cola account across all of their brands. And that was testimony to Coca-Cola at the time, the Coca-Cola company, wanting to do things differently in this market. And there's a few kind of really kind of avant-garde thinkers there who wanted to shake things up. And so we worked with them for the whole time that Naked was around. And then, continue to work with them afterwards as well. So that was kind of cool.
So why sell the firm?
Because I don't know how much I want to disclose. It was a really, really strong brand, but the brand was always bigger than the actual business. And so the brand was set up as being a strategically led business, and then everyone else kind of bolstered up their strategy. The market got smaller and smaller as other people were reinvesting into strategy, and it got hard to maintain that position in the market. And so now Naked's dead. So we sold it to a company who didn't know how to treat it. They fucked it, and now it doesn't exist. But there's no, there isn't another agency in its place that's come in its place. Like them, it had kind of a corrective thing where brands, where agencies started to take strategy more seriously. And so there's not that gap in the market anymore.
So with Thinkabell, I mean, today it's quite obvious when you first started, it was your name that was out there. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's a multi-award-winning agency. It's clearly one of the best independents in the market, in my opinion. I put you up there with Special Group and all those sorts of firms, and that you guys continue to dominate through awards, through just even watching the campaigns. I mean, I think it's pretty obvious. You know, the branding, you've done that really well. Measured Magic, the Tinkerbell logo is really good. Did you just basically take the same approach with Thinkabell as you did with Naked and say, look, we're the people if you want to do stuff different, because that's me?
No. And Jordan, well done. I like the fact that you give a shit and have done a bit of research and understand the dynamics. I think that's really cool. And I've listened to a few of your episodes and I got the same vibe. So it's cool. It's good. One of the things that Naked never was professional. It always felt like it was really, really quite out there.
Yeah.
And one of the things we really wanted to make sure we had in Thinkabell was the measured bit. And we co-founded it. So I co-founded it with two guys called Jim and Cuz. And then we wanted the first person, the other missing bit of a wheel was somebody who came from a media background. And somebody who knew how to really run an agency, as opposed to, whatever we were doing before. And so that person was a woman called Margie Reed, and she's a partner and our boss, and she's the CEO. And she is really structured, really organized, knows how to run things, and we know how to scale it. So I got that right. So we're much more professional than the previous outfit. The other thing we do is we plan and buy, do the strategy, but we also execute and we also make stuff and create stuff. And so Naked was always doing the strategy, then outsourcing the back end. So the model is quite different. But what we have retained, but in a different way, is the hardcore branding of ourselves as well. So the logo, which is Rodan's the Thinker with Tinkerbell's Wings. The rituals, we start every week with Measured Monday. We end every week with Magic Hour. We have thinkers and tinkers. So the tinkers are creatives, the thinkers are the strategists, and they lead every account, which is, again, a different type of model, different way of thinking. And we brand ourselves, right? And we put ourselves out there, and there's constantly news in the market about us. And again, the other thing we've retained is a little bit of antagonism towards the rest of the market, which is good and bad. Maybe dial it down a little bit, but we still have a sense of us versus them a bit.
I think that's definitely the case. I think it also helps as well that in the last 2 years in particular, the holding companies, they made a lot of people redundant, and it's given, I think we're heading into the next decade of the independents, to be honest.
Yeah, it feels like there's a lot of really good independent agencies floating around.
Howardson & Co., you guys.
Yeah.
And Special, I would argue, is independent.
Special are independent. And Special's a New Zealand agency that's now in Australia. They've just opened in the UK, and so they're doing really well. And they had a little bit of the same thing that we had at Naked. They had a really an amazing agency happening in New Zealand, and then they made that happen here. It's absolutely amazing and fantastic. Lots of good agencies floating around. And then I do think if I was in the one of the holding companies right now, it's hard. It's harder. Then you got, the Monkeys are owned by Accenture. That's the other model. And they've been able to retain their culture. They're hoovering up amazing talent in the market, and they're an amazing agency. They've got Dave Drogan now at the helm as well. So they're doing very well.
Yeah, the consulting companies have basically come in and snapped up talent. But sometimes I think for talent, like, it's not always about money. I think the last few years maybe will balance both money and quality of work. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, I think
you're going to be doing interesting campaigns. So I guess I'm curious. I'm very selfish in this question in that I'm an agency owner. Like, the area that we sit, I really found our way organically as an outsider to this space. It was my wife who worked at, she was at PwC when Russell was there, when they started building out that team. We're a very small firm. Obviously, it's 5-6 people. And I'm always thinking about how can we grow, change, understand where we sit. I think our uniqueness fits in this sort of creative X talent crossover, just purely from the fact that we actually manage talent. Do you think that this approach that you had with Naked is the best for businesses like ours? You go out there and you make a name for yourself as a pipsqueak that's just a bit louder than others. Is that the best approach, do you think?
100%. Someone once said to me, there's no business model in flying under the radar. And I think it's really, really cool. And if you just read how brands grow and you understand the principles of mental and physical availability, all you need to do is be in the buyer's head at the time they're making a decision. Mm. And the more time you're in their head at the time they're making a decision as to who to go with, then the more your brand's going to grow. So you have to be constantly in the customer's head, and then you have to be easy to buy. So that means having a strong proposition and something that's very easily memorable and so on and so on. And so just apply the same principles to yourself.
And do you I agree with that. Because that was one of the things I had around like go-to-market of Think About. I mean, at the end of the day, you're a panelist on Gruen, Sky, Project, Your Money, Sunrise, Masters of Spin, multiple media outlets. And I've always been curious, do you think that mental, physical availability is just comes down to you guys doing fucking really good work and then going to talk about it on media?
Yeah. It's never about doing, it's not, it can't be the work, because there's not enough work to do. It's confidence day in market. It just needs to be about finding opportunities to be known. And so that all started, and I think I saw the value of that when I, right back in the day, at Saatchi, I used to write these articles around how to be cool. And I used to write one every month in B&T magazine. Yeah, it was a magazine at the time. And that created a lot of interest. And a lot of people used to want to know who I was who was writing about cool. And so then that taught me just the value of staying top of mind and finding different media outlets to do that within. So I've done Masters Spin on Sunrise for 6 years or 7 years or something. And, you're on the telly, people get comfortable when you're on the telly. There's a thing called the mere exposure effect where you like the more familiar somebody becomes, the more you like it. And so I wouldn't just talk about the work and then try to promote that. I'll think about your own brand and try to make your own brand as big as possible, no matter how big the size of the actual company.
And with Naked in the beginning, how did you do that when you didn't have those accounts? Was it just you guys just getting out there and just talking to people?
Every single thing we did, we saw as a PR opportunity. So when we were looking for somebody, we would chalk write that. We'll write in chalk outside big ad agencies, hey, we're looking for a new planner. And then we'll take a photo of it and we'll annoy that ad agency saying we're looking for a new planner outside their agency and chalk writing on the ground. So every single thing the agency did, we tried to spin it into a PR opportunity.
Yeah, right. I fucking love that. That is amazing. What's for lunch today?
Excuse me. It's Atmos, right? A wonton noodle soup from Crystal.
What's your favorite cuisine?
I pass. All of it. All of it's good.
All of it's good. No biases here. Okay, no. Let's talk about the science side of things. I've got a decent preamble for you here, but like I said earlier, I've gone deep on Mark Ritson, Byron Sharp. I think it was Chris from Howardson & Co. who basically recommended the Byron Sharp book. I read that and I was like, holy shit. The whole cognitive science angle is just one layer to what is happening in this new evidence-based marketing push, let's call it. I just purchased the long and short of it. So you got Burnett and Les. I think organizations like yours, Hard Hat, and others really dominate this sort of cognitive science space simply because that's your niche, right? That's what allows you to stand out. Marketing science today is fascinating, but like I think about it for the CMO, it's also fucking confusing. Like it's really, I don't know, like how do you make a decision as a CMO as to what's the best direction when it comes to agency, your strategy or whatever it may be? Have you ever found a way, at least right now, to condense in 2-3 sentences or less to CMOs what really matters when it comes to marketing and or advertising? Again, the example with Les and Burnett is they talk about the long and the short. The long is brand-based marketing and the short is very transactional, targeted marketing that gets sales. Do you hold that same view?
It's a good question, right? So before marketing sciences came along, there was nothing. It was all just fucking make shit up. And so I don't think marketing sciences has made things confusing. I think it's simplified things a little bit. And I think the master of doing that is Byron Sharp, who has taken, and all that Mark Byron's done is taken what the Ehrenberg Bass Institute has found over years and years and years of research and put them into a book to make it easy for people to digest. And there's lots of principles there about how to build a brand and how brands grow. And, you know, creating mental and physical availability, being there at the when the trigger's occurring, just showing how much disdain people actually have for your advertising and how heavily branded it needs to be in order for people to actually understand that it's your brand talking to them, making sure you turn up as your brand and being distinctive and looking like your brand, et cetera. So basic principles which can get covered and spoken about in a half-hour meeting and say, this is the evidence. So that's one thing. So it's not hard. What's hard is the applicability of that. So you have a media agency who's not okay with it or who has done a deal with a big company and has to sell their media and wants to do the media in bursts, even though the continuity is the right way to build a brand and so on. So there's kind of the applicability of the science, which can get hard. Mm. And right at the front end of it all, around positioning, which is this whole distinctiveness versus differentiation debate, there's the how do you create a brand like Riddle and with all these kind of beautiful rituals and this the subtlety we were talking about before and that kind of magic layer. And that's really where I still feel like there's in that within that world there's so much creativity, and you just have to be really creative, for want of a more pointed word, on how to do that. And I don't think there are that many. I don't think there's that many books that can tell you how to do that.
No.
And so that's the reason why I started this podcast with Brent called Black T-Shirts, which you mentioned in your intro. And that's about imploring marketers to be more creative, as everything's going evidence-based, which is good, and which I'm massively a supporter of. You still got to find ways to be creative and find interesting creative solutions for either building the brand, understanding what the brand's about, creating those rituals or that overall customer experience in certain ways.
Yeah. Okay.
So maybe the analogy is that marketing sciences is the foundation on which you should be building your brands. And then on top of that, you're finding opportunities to be creative.
Yeah, so maybe this new wave of marketing science has swung the pendulum so far towards the science realm that people need to not lose sight of the creative element, which it's not is about, a qualitative thing.
No, it's not about swinging, because that is, within that you implied it's one or the other, whereas it's more about the foundation needs to be bullshit and you used to have creativity on top of bullshit. Now the foundation is marketing sciences, and you've got creativity on top of marketing sciences.
Yeah, right. When it comes to the field of advertising, who do you respect? Like, who's the, you know, the go-to when it comes to cognitive science, when it comes to all that sort of stuff?
At the risk of at the risk of saying three white blokes, the three people who pop into my head are Byron Sharp, Mark Ritson, and Dave Draeger. And so, you know, they're the three people who I will digest and read, no matter what they say, and kind of process it, I guess.
Okay, and this is Dave from Busy Pixel?
No, this is Dave from Draeger 5. So Drake, he's an Australian who started started Draeger 5, and he's now the global chief creative officer of Accenture Interactive.
Gotcha.
And he, you know, somebody described him recently as being like Bradman, and all of us, the rest of us, are playing cricket. He's really good.
You're right. I do like that. Right. Before we jump into these rapid fire questions, I've got a few little things I want to ask you. You do a lot of these interviews. I've seen them all over the years. What's the question? There's two sides to this question. One, what do you get asked repeatedly that you wish you just stopped getting asked? And two, what don't you get asked that you wish you could talk about more?
The whole thing about marketing sciences, the questions you just asked me about what its role and is it too sciencey, I get asked a lot. but that's okay, because it's a new field of knowledge as well, I reckon. I'm so excited by it because it gives us language and all that kind of stuff to describe what we do, and the fact that so many people still don't know about it is amazing. Also, I just wanted to say within that, it's a part of behavioral economics. I should have also mentioned Daniel Kahneman in the Four White Blokes, who I read everything about. and then the question I don't get asked, maybe this is going to sound really trite, but I do like success to be holistic, and I do want people to see the value of success is about a whole life. And I'm very proud of my family and my wife and my kids, and people kind of separate it. So they're talking about business and marketing and advertising and stuff. But I hate this whole thing I hate Tim Ferriss and that whole fucking, you can be amazing, you can be whatever you want, just if, as long as you eat one noodle a day and have an ice bath while standing on one leg. It's like, fuck off.
Yeah, it's the whole, I love that whole shtick, like the taking the piss of it. It's called like Sigma Grindset and like Sigma Male, and there's a whole song behind it, and it's like, right, you know, Mega Chad, and like, oh, this guy's such a Chad, and he has ice bars. And one of the funniest Instagram profiles at the moment is called Entrepreneur. I'll get Jacob to link it in our show notes for everyone. But like, some of the quotes on this are just fucking amazing, and people don't realize that it's taking the piss, which is something I love about Australian culture and our ability in advertising is, that is something that allows us to stand out quite a bit, is that sort of there's no sacred cows in Australian culture a lot of the time.
That's great, isn't it? You can bust through shit.
You can bust through anything.
But when I meet someone like you, I think, oh, God, you know, you seem very confident, you're very articulate, very intelligent, you've got your whole, you're ambitious, and, you know, your life's going to be fucking good. But people aren't necessarily born into that, and then other people or don't have those skills innately or whatever, or don't have a mindset or whatever, or something's happened to them and puts them off course. And it just creates, just even talking about these kind of things and what's your secret to this and that, it just creates more and more anxiety for the people who who aren't there or who aren't going to do it. And it just makes it harder and harder for people to look around and go, oh, shit, my life's pretty good because I'm not dead at all. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so, you've got a roof over your head and you can...
Yeah. So that's all what's come out of when you said, what are you not being asked? And nobody's getting on, having a podcast with me and going, hey, tell me about your relationship with your wife. And I don't necessarily want to talk about that, but I don't know.
No, I know what you're saying is, the worst thing you can do is compare yourself to others.
Totally.
Like that, I think that's a big thing, but I am personally, like you say, I've got my shit put together, but I am very guilty of that. Like sometimes I will do that and I can't because I've got to go back to, so long as I'm improving by X amount, learning, that's all that matters. And I'm a lazy cunt. Like I got up at 9:30 this morning. Like,
yeah, you know, that's a good message. That's good.
The intriguing thing for me is like doing all these interviews and talking and, you know, people being vulnerable and I guess doing the research, which makes them vulnerable in the process as they talk about what is actually happening in their lives. And you start to realize when you condense them all together, which is a hard thing to convey to someone unless they've listened to 20 plus episodes of this show, is that the reality is when it comes to success and how you frame it, there is not a way that works. Like there are components to it. There is hard work. There is luck. There is skill. But sometimes some people are just overweighted in one particular area. Like maybe there's a really conscientious person, and because of that, they work in, like, look at Elon Musk. You know, he works 7 days a week, 15, 16 hours a day, and people say that it's luck. Well, it's not, because that's his skill set. Is the guy is happy to basically kill himself working to do some very interesting things. But some other people are just incredibly intelligent and can make moves smarter, make moves faster, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I don't think there's one size that fits all, so to speak.
No, I don't think so. But I do think most of it is out of our control.
Most of it is, yeah. All right. Let's finish off with some rapid fire questions. You're munching on some lunch.
I'll stop eating my noodles for this bit.
Well, for this first one, I got to ask you, what's your go-to item in the fridge at home?
There's Kappa probiotic milk. I don't even quite know what it is.
Yeah,
but it's a liter of thick, yogurty Kappa lime milk of some sort. It's really good.
Yeah, kefir. Makes your shit good.
Kefir. It makes your shit good, did you say?
It makes your shit good, yeah.
Ah, good.
Okay. You mentioned before was the book I was just looking at, The Culting of Brands.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any other books that really stand out in the same realm as Byron Sharp's books or Les and Burnett's book, The Long and Short of It? Anything like that, do you think, in the last 5 to 7 years that's really come out and changed your perspective on the game?
Yes, there is. There's a really good book called How Advertising Works.
Oh, yeah.
And it's written by a guy called Robert Heath. And and it talks a lot about low involvement processing.
Yeah.
And his argument is that the less you pay attention to advertising, the more effective it is. Because as soon as you start to pay attention to it and process it, you start to build up reactance and think of cognitive messages why not to believe this thing. And so emotional advertising that just seeps into the head is much more effective.
So who's that by again?
Robert Heath.
Robert Heath.
And it's called something like How Advertising Works. Okay. And the other one is Orlando Bloom has written a book called Lemon, which is really good as well.
Okay. What's Lemon about?
So it's kind of taking their field B&A stuff and making it a little bit more entertaining.
Interesting. Lemon with, what's his name again?
Orlando Bloom.
Orlando Bloom.
Or is that the famous actor?
That's the actor I was going to say.
The land owes something or other. It's called lemon. By the end of this podcast, one of us will be able to tell you.
Jacob, I can. Oh no, it's Leaf who does the interviews. Orlando Wood.
Wood bloom. Bloody hell, that's reasonable.
How the advertising brain turns sour. Yeah, right. Interesting. All right, last question for you. Podcast, doc, or a movie you've been watching lately?
Death Note, a manga series on Netflix is amazing. It's amazing. So really intricate storylines, unreal characters, really out there premise. It's fantastic.
Yeah, right. Very interesting. I didn't realize you're into manga, did you say, or anime?
I'm not. Manga. I said manga. What's the difference?
I think anime and manga's porn.
Anime is it? Yeah. Are you kidding? No. It's anime. Oh, my God. Yeah.
That's so funny.
Hang on. Is manga porn?
I don't know. Look, mate, I'm no weeb, so I couldn't tell you with
manga
any.
Manga are comics or graphic novels originating from Japan, conform to a style developed in Japan. Nah, you're. I don't know what the difference between manga and anime is. I feel better, but having, I don't think it's porn.
Manga versus anime. I don't know. That's a good question. I've always wondered that. Anime and manga are two distinct mediums. Manga, okay, they're the novels and comics in black and white. Whereas anime are typically TV shows or movies, and they're often in color.
Gotcha. Okay. It's anime. You're right.
I know, but there is definitely, like, I remember having this conversation with Jake about producer, and he's like, dude, because he's really into anime. And yeah, it's bizarre that whole, he's really into Japanese culture and stuff like that. And manga just, I don't know, quickly devolves into porn, apparently. It's very bizarre cultural thing when you go over there. Anyway,
there's a saying in Batman, the brighter the picture, the darker the negative. And I love that, because I think about that with Japanese culture and so forth, is beautiful, clean imagery and then really kind of dark themes underneath it and all the, you know,
fetishes. Yeah, I agree with that. It's I don't know if you've been to Japan, but I've been like four times in the last 5 years. And I don't know, it's that there's only three cultures in the world that are quite similar: Japanese, Greek culture, which is my background, and Arabic culture. And it's because they all have what you call public versus private face. So what you do and say in public is different to what you do and say in private. And wow, that creates like massive societal issues.
I think the other thing for Japan that dials it up is it's a monoculture still, being an island, no influence. So it's kind of quite pure, for want of a...
Yeah, 97% of Japanese citizens are born in Japan or Japanese.
Yeah, right.
And the 3% that aren't are typically like Korean or Chinese. Mm. Like you don't find many Australians or Americans with Japanese citizenship, so to speak. Adam, thank you for coming on the show. Where can people find you on the interwebs?
LinkedIn. I'm pretty active. At Adam Ferrier on Twitter. Black T-Shirts Podcast on Listener. That'll do, surely.
That's it. We'll link you. Where are you most prolific? LinkedIn, Twitter, or Instagram?
Actually, LinkedIn now, I think.
Yeah, right. Okay. Well, we'll make sure we'll link all of that. But Adam, thanks for coming on the show.
Good on you. That was fun. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for checking out this episode. If you liked it, do subscribe, and of course, like it on YouTube if you're watching as well. We'd really appreciate that. For audio, if you've not already listening on your podcast app, you can search for it on any good app, including Spotify, Pocket Casts, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, etc. For video, if you're not watching, you can search Uncommon Podcast on YouTube. It's the first one that appears every single time. For behind the scenes, do follow us on Instagram and TikTok. It's @uncommon_show. But until next time, thanks for tuning in.